I'm Duarte Geraldino, and this is The Takeaway.
This really is an attack on our government, which means it's an attack on all of us.
Rethinking public safety priorities after a ransomware attack paralyzed the city of Atlanta. Plus, it's opening day for America's pastime, but did Major League Baseball just pull a fast one on its minor leaguers?
Just because a person is chasing a dream doesn't mean that a company shouldn't be required to comply with basic minimum wage laws.
And we continue our series, Taking Pains with Women's Health, with a look at the gaps in medical research.
There's a one-size-fits-all dosage, which means that on average, women are sort of being overdosed on a lot of drugs.
Busy, busy show, folks. This is The Takeaway for Thursday, March 29th, 2018. Think about this for a second. An American city under cyber attack stopped in its tracks. Sounds like something out of the movies, right? Think Die Hard 6 or something like that.
Shall we play a game?
Oh.
But just last week, the real-life, actual city of Atlanta was taken offline. It was held hostage. The city's computers were hit by the type of cyber attack that's known as ransomware. But as Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms says,
this is much bigger than a ransomware attack. This really is an attack on our government, which means it's an attack on all of us.
These attacks lock users out of computers until a ransom is paid. In this case, the hackers are asking for about $51,000. And while some municipal systems in Atlanta are just coming back online this week, these types of attacks are becoming increasingly common. This is because hackers know cities across the U.S. rely on digital networks to take care of everyday business. And that's where we start today. I'm Duarte Geraldino, and this is The Takeaway. Ian Bogos is here. He's professor at Georgia Tech and a contributing editor at The Atlantic. Hey, Ian.
Hello.
So, Ian, what exactly happened in Atlanta over the past week?
So this ransomware attack began last Thursday. The group responsible is known as SamSam, and they very frequently execute these attacks. They've collected almost $1 million in ransomware collections just this year. The systems that were attacked, it's still exactly unclear how they got in. Sometimes this happens through incursions into the system. Sometimes it's like a phishing attack, you know, when you get an email and click a link that appears to go somewhere but actually goes somewhere different and downloads software onto a system. And then once the malware is installed, and it could have happened months and months ago, then it can spread within those systems until the hackers turn it on, so to speak.
This is how it happens, and they have already collected about $1 million through various attacks so far. Is this what you're telling me?
Yeah, and it's not just governments. Obviously, governments are what we're thinking about this week, especially in Atlanta. But health organizations, educational organizations, corporations, all of them, anybody who uses a computer network and might have the money to pay a ransom is at risk of these attacks.
So how is the city doing now? What is Atlanta doing to get things back online?
Well, sometimes it's unclear exactly what's going on from a citizen's perspective. Many of the systems that you would ordinarily use to do daily business with the city are unavailable. So if you want to pay your utility bill, your water bill, can't do that right now. The municipal courts have been the most affected. They're completely offline. They can't process warrants or tickets. They're conducting all their business with pen and paper this week. It's the little things, really, that I've noticed. I tried to park at the airport, and while I could park there, I couldn't get my receipt out of the online system. You know, one of the things about infrastructure, and this is an infrastructural attack, is infrastructure kind of disappears into the background. You don't notice it until it doesn't work anymore. And it just turns out that more and more of us rely on computers for infrastructure to conduct our daily business.
And you don't know you need it until it's gone. Now, I want to bring in someone else who knows what Atlanta is going through. Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings is also with us. Mayor Rawlings, remind us what happened in Dallas in April of 2017.
Hello, Duarte. We had those same sort of attacks. We've had two instances, one which was in 17, where someone was just rejiggered the siren system, and it was a low-tech issue that sent the sirens off all night. And everybody said, all right, we're under attack, if you will. In fact, it was old technology that could be easily rooted around, and as I said, with low technology.
And these are the storm sirens, right? These storm sirens.
Tornado sirens. I got calls all night. I was out of town. What's happening to our city? And then this spring, we had attacks from offshore, okay, that was much like this, and we were able to stop them very quickly, call in the FBI and find out where that was, and we have been able to improve our system. Look, you've got to always be one step ahead of the bad actors, so you're running pretty fast.
It seems like everyone's running pretty fast at this point. So you said you improved the system. At the time of the attack, how prepared was the city for any sort of cyber attack?
Well, obviously, we weren't prepared for no incursion, but we were pleased that we were prepared to stop it early in the process, so we didn't shut down all the systems. It came to us a little bit, and we were able to, as I said, plug the dike, if you would.
Plug the dike. Ian, I want to go back to you for a second, because in The Atlantic, you write that these types of attacks are becoming more common, almost mundane. Why would you say that?
Well, so much of what we do with computers, and so many of the things that we do with computers involve information, personal information, critical systems that we've connected to the internet. And once you connect computers to the internet, you effectively connect them to all the other computers in the world, including those of these hackers. So you think about something like the Equifax breach last year, or what we're currently thinking about with respect to Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, or even just the kind of ordinary problems you face with your machine when it gets a virus or something like that. Our expectations in some way have changed, and we know that we like to use computers and they make certain things easier, but they also are more subject to these kinds of flaws and faults.
So what should cities be doing around the country to better prepare for this, Ian?
Well, certainly they should take their audits seriously and consider increasing their security, their attention to these kinds of attacks. There was an audit conducted last year in the city of Atlanta, which appears to have shown that the city was at risk. You know, there's only so much you can do, but certainly increasing security is one thing. I mean, if you leave it up to corporate IT folk, they'd tell you don't do anything, sort of like lawyers sometimes tell you that, and that's not viable either. One thing that I'm thinking about a bit is so-called smart cities technology, so connecting more city infrastructure to the internet. This might be something that cities want to reconsider or at least pull back on until they've kind of figured out what the implications might be. My understanding of the situation in Dallas last year was that emergency sirens, like tornado sirens, were one of the elements that hackers got control of and could set off. And that's certainly the kind of thing that you don't want to happen. You know, traffic control systems, transit systems, all of those kinds of systems that are being sold to consumers and to municipalities as the future of an internet-connected life in an urban environment. That might be something worth taking a second look at. Another thing that's worth knowing about is that there are insurance providers now that cover this kind of attack. You can get cyber insurance that might pay off the ransom or might pay for consultants. And this is, apparently a part of everyday life for governments and for businesses as well.
So now there's cyber insurance in order to pay off ransoms. Mayor Rawlings, Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms said that the city's cybersecurity was not a priority before the attack. Was that the case in Dallas?
Well, I think we have priorities in different areas, and making sure everything gets up to snuff is what's important. In the case of our siren issue, it was older technology that had not been replaced, and so we had to replace that. So you've got to, on all fronts, deal with this because, citizens are wanting smart cities. I mean, this is the big thing. Citizens understand that technology is there. They want to make it easy, and they want public safety. They want to be safe on all aspects, and technology is a part of that. So I don't think we can let up on pushing for citizen interaction and transparency. What we have to do is figure out how to spend money correctly. We have to get aligned at the federal level because we're not. We need to get DHS and DOJ to take this seriously. We've got to have a culture of vigilance on this. And this isn't going to change, but we got to keep pushing forward.
So you say you have to get aligned on a federal level because it's not. Can you explore that a little bit more? What is the holdup? What do you think that the federal government is doing that is handicapping the local response?
Well, I think the feds look at the borders and say our job is to keep those safe. So let's go spend billions of dollars on a wall or spend money in Asia to kind of prop up police cities and to make sure they're safe for our folks. But they're not looking at cities. That we do not have a conversation at the city level about what is necessary to keep our citizens safe. They delegate that to the cities, underfund those sort of things, and then talk strong about these issues as if it's important for Americans, but we're not doing anything at that local level. I experienced that when we faced Ebola some years ago. And everybody is an expert, but nobody really knows how to protect, whether it's on a disease level or a cybersecurity level. These things, as we see with guns, everybody talks, but there's no action.
Ian, I want to turn back to Atlanta in this case, because this was a ransomware attack. Do we know if there was any payment made?
The deadline was Wednesday, and as I entered the studio today, I had not yet heard whether or not the payment was made. The city was going back and forth about what they were going to do. There was some confusion about whether it was even possible, some sort of technical issue with the portal where they were supposed to reach the hackers. So as I sit here talking to you right now, I don't know. And even if the payment is made, it may take some time before the systems come back online, before the computers are released, and before the whole thing gets cleaned up.
And exactly how much were they looking for? $51,000? Is that right?
Yes, 6 bitcoins, which is about $51,000 at current rates.
How do they come up with that particular figure?
Well, you know, they're looking for a figure that the city is likely to pay, but also that's meaningful enough to justify the work.
Thank you very much, Ian Bogost, professor at Georgia Tech, and Mayor Mike Rawlings of Dallas. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Thank you.
It's been rumored for weeks, and on Wednesday evening, President Donald Trump made it official, on Twitter, of course, Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin is out, and in the coming weeks, Shulkin will be replaced by Navy Admiral Ronnie Jackson. Jackson is currently the physician to the president. That's an actual official White House position. You may remember Jackson from that bizarre press conference in January after he gave President Trump a checkup.
It's some people have, you know, just great genes. You know, I told the president that if he had a healthier diet over the last 20 years, he might live to be 200 years old. I don't know. I mean, he has incredible genes. I just assume. I mean, you know, if I didn't watch what I ate, I wouldn't have in the cardiac and overall health that he has. So he's very healthy. But I would say the answer to your question is he has incredibly good genes, and it's just the way God made him.
Yeah, we all had to take a breath after that one. Meanwhile, David Shulkin was an Obama-era holdover. Some say he was politically targeted. He's accused of spending abuses, mismanagement, among other issues. To help us make sense of this, we're joined by Asuwin Subsang. He's a White House reporter at the Daily Beast. Asuwin, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So why did President Trump replace Shulkin?
Well, there's a multitude of reasons here. Trump's VA during the Shulkin era was defined by a good amount of backstabbing, palace intrigue, ideological turf warfare, and press freelancing on Shulkin's part that just became a huge distraction, whatever one thought of Shulkin's policies or whatever President Donald Trump thought of David Shulkin. President Trump, at the onset, personally liked Shulkin a lot, but the position that Shulkin put himself in, which included, as you pointed out, stemming from an IG report that found that there were potentially spending abuses by him at the senior staff level, certainly put an air of potential corruption in his reign at the Veterans Affairs that made it, quite frankly, completely untenable for him to remain in his position. Senior officials in the administration, who we'd been speaking to for weeks, had been saying that it was a matter of when, definitely not if, when Trump would have to fire Shulkin.
Asawin, so he's accused of doing a lot of things over here. Put this into perspective for us.
Well, as he approached the end of his tenure at the VA, he began to think that so many people within the senior ranks of the VA were out to get him, including in his own communications operation. So he brought in outsiders from an outside public relations firm, essentially, to help him basically puff up his image to publications such as the New York Times as scandals swirled around him, including allegations stemming from the IG report that came out in recent months that alleged, among other things, that he had misused taxpayer funds in a trip to Europe that included him, his wife, and his staff. And his level of paranoia or distrust of his own staff and also senior White House officials reached a point where included him also initiating the unusual move of stationing an armed guard outside of his own office at the VA.
Okay, so what do we know about his replacement, Ronny Jackson?
Well, Ronny Jackson, the main difference there is that he is someone who the president at this point deeply trusts. It's hard to find an official who spends as much time with Donald Trump as Ronny Jackson, his personal physician, does. Having said that, there is nothing to indicate that Ronny Jackson has what would usually be deemed adequate experience in an administration to run a bureaucracy as sprawling and as large as Veterans Affairs. The president likes him a lot. He's a perfectly competent physician, but there is some hesitation from veterans groups to fully get behind him, at least at this point, because Veterans Affairs is something right now that has been plagued by bureaucratic hell and varying degrees of what a lot of people would label as corruption. And they just don't have full confidence that someone with his credentials is someone who can come in and really clean things up and wrangle people properly.
What about the VA itself? How will it fare?
Well, it's hard to tell at this point. A big reason that allies of David Shulkin wanted him to stay, even though they were incredibly displeased by the allegation of spending abuses, was because they believed that he was standing in between them, the VA, and the forces of what they would label or criticize as privatization. Playing out only barely behind the scenes of all of this David Shulkin mess was an ideological turf battle between people within and without the administration who want to open up the VA to more, shall we say, privatization in terms of veterans' health care, and those who absolutely do not and think that could potentially lead to a road to ruin. So in the post-Shulkin era for Trump's VA, look out for more political squabbles that have to do with how much veterans' care should be essentially relocated to private health services.
So just to be clear, do you believe that veterans will be hurt by this shuffle?
Honestly, I think veterans have been hurt throughout this entire shuffle. I mean, as there's been heavy, heavy doses of palace intrigue over the past several months and squabbling and backbiting and inability to trust people within senior staff, not just in the VA, but within the administration, the White House, who work on these issues every day. It's been an incredible distraction from both sides of the ideological aisle in terms of people who actually ostensibly want to help veterans who are suffering and ailing. And that is what gets lost as the administration has entered several rounds of intense feuding over these things.
So the fact that Shulkin is out, Jackson is in, what does that point to in the Trump cabinet?
Well, currently it points to a level of tumult and chaos that has become all too common within the Trump administration and the Trump cabinet. I mean, we've seen this with National Security Advisor. We've seen this with National Economic Council Director. And now it's hit the top ranks of the VA. And quite frankly, at this point, if there were more turnover to happen in the administration, I don't think anybody would be too surprised. This has been an administration that has seen a historically high rate of turnover at the senior ranks within and without the West Wing. So it's just another example of buckle up.
Just another example of buckle up. Thank you so much, Aswin Subsang, White House reporter at The Daily Beast.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Duarte Geraldino. Today, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker announced a special election will be held on June 12. There are two open seats, one in the state Senate, the other in Wisconsin's Assembly. This special election would normally not be big news. You see, the seats have been vacant since December, but Walker had been holding out on making the announcement, so the courts got involved. And now this. Sean Johnson is the Capitol Bureau Chief at Wisconsin Public Radio. He's with us now. Hey, Sean.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's back up. What's going on here? Why was Governor Walker resisting holding these special elections in the first place?
We don't know why exactly, because normally special elections are just a normal occurrence in Wisconsin. When somebody vacates a seat, state law calls for the governor to fill that seat or call for an election to fill that seat as quickly as possible. And that didn't happen here. The governor has said it's because it would be a waste of taxpayer money to call elections for these seats when, by the time they were filled, the legislature would be done with its business for 2018. Democrats have said the real reason Walker's been resisting is because he's afraid that Republicans will lose the seats, because that's what happened the last time there was a special election in Wisconsin. Democrats flipped a seat that had been Republican since 2001 and that Donald Trump carried by 17 points in 2016.
So there was a political motivation, perhaps, in this case.
There could have been. I mean, there's been a real resistance to something that's pretty commonplace in Wisconsin. And to the point that Governor Walker was willing to dig in, fight this in court, and up until recently, to the point where there were plans by Republican legislators and the governor to pass a bill to rewrite Wisconsin's special election laws entirely. That's something you don't see every day. And those were both steps that the Republicans in Wisconsin were willing to take to try to fight these elections.
It seems like the governor's hand is really being forced right now. In the past, he had claimed that the special elections would be a waste of taxpayer money. But now they're going forward. Are we to believe this is because the court stepped in?
It's absolutely because the court stepped in. If they hadn't, these elections would not have happened. These seats would have been vacant for more than a year, which, as far as we know, has not happened in Wisconsin in like the last 50 years. The governor made that argument in court that this would be a waste of money. He was rebuked pretty strongly by an appellate court judge yesterday. This was Judge Paul Riley, who wrote, quote, "Representative government and the election of our representatives are never unnecessary, never a waste of taxpayer resources, and the calling of special elections are, as the governor acknowledges, his obligation to follow." So the governor's argument that these would be a waste of money did not carry any weight in the court system, which said the governor had a clear obligation under the law to call these elections.
If we could focus on these two seats, who held them? Who wants them?
They're held by Republicans. And, you know, honestly, there's a chance that Republicans could win them again. But the way that things are going in Wisconsin and elsewhere in these special elections throughout the country, Democrats are getting some pickups that they wouldn't have gotten a couple years ago. The pendulum seems to be swinging their way. And so already after the governor ordered these special elections for June 12th and the state legislature dropped plans to try to block those elections, you've already seen a Democrat announce their candidacy for the state Senate district. So this is already an election in progress.
If you could briefly tell me, how are Wisconsin voters taking this news?
This is something that has gotten people riled up in a way that we haven't seen in Wisconsin in a while for a state issue. This plan to restrict special elections seemed to get people, as particularly Democrats or the Democratic base, pretty angry. And they were charged up to fight this in court.
This is what happens when you get people angry. Thank you so much, Sean Johnson, Capitol Bureau Chief at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you.
The one constant through all the years, Ray, has been baseball.
Strike ball out. Here comes the pitch. Strike three.
That is hammered into left.
Okay, let's get to it.
We're contenders now.
My job is to be a professional goofball.
That's why it's baseball.
Baseball is back today, at least for the major leagues. The minor leagues, on the other hand, have to wait another week until next Thursday. But here's something you may not have heard about. This season might be a lot more difficult for thousands of minor league players because of a small provision in the federal spending bill that was just passed last week. It's on page 1967, and it's called the Save America's Pastime Act. The provision exempts minor league players from federal labor law requirements, meaning players could make well below minimum wage. Garrett Brushhouse knows all too well the challenges of being a minor league player. He was a minor league pitcher in the San Francisco Giants farm system from 2004 to 2009. Now he's an attorney fighting for minor league players' rights. Garrett, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what's the Save America's Pastime Act?
Well, you know, unfortunately, it's an exemption from our basic minimum wage laws for Major League Baseball. It was really quite surprising that it made it in there. You know, this is an industry that's a $12 billion industry. MLB has seen revenue growing exponentially. And instead of doing the right thing and raising the salaries for minor league players, as we've been fighting for a few years now, you know, they spent over $2.6 million lobbying Congress the last couple of years and succeeded getting an exemption from our minimum wage laws tacked onto a spending bill, even though it has nothing to do with government spending at all.
So in 2016 and 2017, Major League Baseball spent something along the lines of $1.32 million on lobbying expenses. Were they behind the lobbying efforts?
Oh, without a doubt. This is directly related to our efforts to increase salaries. You know, we've been trying to bring attention to the matter, and we've been trying to ask them and make them comply with just our country's basic minimum wage laws, you know, the same laws that Walmart and McDonald's comply with. But unfortunately, you know, they decided to try to flex their political muscle and hire powerful lobbyists, and they succeeded in getting our Congress to insert something that isn't needed at all for the industry, and that's going to harm thousands of minor league players.
So you say it isn't needed at all in the industry, and it's going to harm players. How will this actually affect the lives of minor league players?
Well, it's rough, and especially this time of year, it's rough. You know, one of the things we have been trying to change is their ability to not pay players during spring training. So most people don't realize that players are only paid during the season. And even during the season, the salary started only $1,100 per month. So players only make a few thousand dollars per year. And one of the toughest time periods for them is spring training, because they're expected to work every day during spring training. So a month straight of work, often 10-hour days, so 50 to 70-hour work weeks. And they aren't paid at all for that work.
So you used to do this. What was your day-to-day life like when you were a player?
It's tough. You know, guys survive a couple of ways. One, there are a few guys that do get decent signing bonuses, but those are the minority of guys. And so they can use their signing bonuses. But again, since that's the minority, most people can't do that. The other players have to lean on family to get by, to help them with rent, to help them with food bills, just their normal day-to-day expenses. They often lean on family. If they aren't lucky enough to have family that can help them out, I see guys resort to credit card debt. You know, I remember riding on a bus a couple of times, and one of my teammates would receive phone calls from debt collectors. So here he is, he's, you know, 23, 24, and he's in professional baseball, trying to reach his lifelong dream, and he already has debt collectors calling him. I mean, it was really an unfortunate thing.
Is that why they stick to it? Because there's this dream that you're going to make it to the big leagues and get one of those, you know, six or seven figure contracts?
Yeah, so that's the carrot that's dangled in front of them. But just because a person is chasing a dream doesn't mean that a company shouldn't be required to comply with basic minimum wage laws. You know, there are all kinds of industries where you have the opportunity to grow, and you have the opportunity to climb the ladder and at the end of the day, hopefully make a lot of money. But we have basic minimum wage laws for a reason, so that companies don't exploit workers. And so companies, if there is an excess supply of labor, can't suppress the wages below a livable wage.
And you're trying to change that, right? You're challenging this. You have a court case right now, hey?
Yeah, so we brought our case all the way back in 2014. And so it's been working its way through the court system since it's a new type of lawsuit. It's the first of its kind, trying to apply our basic minimum wage laws to minor league baseball players. And instead of letting that court process play out, though, Major League Baseball bought itself an exemption.
Garrett Brushhouse, attorney and former minor league baseball player with the San Francisco Giants organization. Thank you.
Thank you.
Back on The Takeaway now. I'm Duarte Geraldino. We've been talking about women's health all this week and why women still struggle to get the care and empathy they need across many medical conditions. Today, we turn to the realities of research and testing in medicine, which has often excluded women. Now, you might already know that recent history contains some explanations for this. Take high-profile drug disasters like thalidomide in the 1950s. That drug was given to pregnant women in dozens of countries to combat nausea. Because their mothers took the medicine, about 10,000 babies were born deformed. The scandal contributed to important federal drug regulations, but it also made researchers nervous about using women of childbearing age in their studies. And that's just one piece of this story.
We're still sort of feeling the legacy of sort of decades of research that was done mainly on men.
That's Maya Dusenberry, author of the new book called Doing Harm, The Truth About How Bad Medicine and Lazy Science Leave Women Dismissed, Misdiagnosed, and Sick. She explains how this disparity came to be and the way forward.
For centuries, medicine was in some ways sort of preoccupied with women's poor health. In the 19th and 18th centuries, there was a lot of focus on women's hysteria and nervous disorders, and really sort of emphasizing the differences between men and women in a way that was using those differences to sort of justify women's inferior position. And in more recent years, I think there's been a little bit of a shift to not taking account those differences at all, and instead having this sort of one-size-fits-all approach that has also not been good for women because it left out the differences that we really do need to understand and really affect women's medical care.
If you could be really specific in terms of those differences, oftentimes we hear that the only difference between men and women are their reproductive capacities, but there's so much more.
Yeah, this is, you know, people have kind of referred to this as the bikini medicine approach, where medicine has sort of acknowledged differences, but only in terms of the breasts and reproductive tract. But in fact, you know, we know that women have higher prevalence rates of lots of conditions like autoimmune diseases, which affect 50 million people in the U.S. 75% of those people are women, and chronic pain conditions disproportionately affect women. We also know that when it comes to diseases that affect both men and women, there are often differences in how those diseases manifest themselves. So heart disease is a great example, if only because I think it's one of the ones that's been most researched. You know, we now, over the past couple decades, have really started going back and recognizing that after 35 years of mainly studying heart disease in men, now we should sort of look at it in women. And it turns out that there are actually differences in symptoms and risk factors. And now there's a sort of newly recognized female pattern heart disease that we previously didn't recognize at all.
One of the things that you mention in your book is that a lot of medicine is really based on a white man who weighs about 154 pounds. How does the fact that medicine is based on this white man who weighs 154 pounds translate into the development of drugs that women are using?
As recently as the early 90s, the FDA still had a policy on the books actually prohibiting all women of childbearing age from being included in early phase drug trials. And there was sort of a more general hesitancy about including women in drug research. And certainly, you know, after some advocacy in the early 90s, that's changed a bit. But there are certainly still drugs that are on the market that were studied largely in men. We now recognize that there are actually important sex differences when it comes to how lots of drugs are metabolized. And those differences arise from sort of a complicated mix of factors. You know, hormones and differences in enzymes and body fat percentage. But it's also just a difference in average body weight, right? Men are on average heavier than women. But even that sort of straightforward, simple difference is not usually accounted for. You know, there's a one size fits all dosage, which means that on average, women are sort of being overdosed on a lot of drugs.
I want to make sure I understand that you're saying that women are oftentimes being overdosed. And in your book, you write, it's perhaps not surprising that women are 50 to 75% more likely than men to have an adverse drug reaction. Is it because of these differences?
I think we're sort of just at the start of understanding these differences fully. You know, it was 2014 that the FDA announced that they were going to slash the recommended dosage of Ambien, the, you know, popular insomnia drug, in half for women. And that was after they had done studies that showed that because women metabolize the drug so much more slowly than men do, after, you know, 8 hours when they were the next morning might still be drowsy and drowsy enough to have their driving impaired and were getting into accidents. And, you know, at that time, the director of the Office of Women's Health at NIH pointed out that, you know, this is really just the tip of the iceberg. There are plenty of drugs besides Ambien that we just, you know, either haven't done the research on or don't fully understand those sex differences. When it comes to preclinical research on pain using animals, it's still the case that about 80% of studies just use male animals, despite the fact that we know that there are actually some real differences. So in the early 90s, when, you know, a federal law was passed to require that NIH-funded research include women, that only applied actually to clinical research with humans. And it's, for the past 25 years, remained the case that the default when it comes to animal studies is really just male animals. And it's only in the last few years that NIH has really focused on that issue and said preclinical researchers also need to be accounting for sex and including both sexes.
So we know this is a problem. How do we move forward? How do we address this disparity and get women the medical attention that they deserve?
I think there's a growing recognition that we do have this emerging body of sex and gender-specific medical knowledge, and a lot of the problem is that a lot of that knowledge just hasn't yet been sort of systematically integrated into medical education. That's in part just because changing medical curricula is a hard, slow-moving process, but I think we are seeing more acknowledgement that that is something that needs to happen. And I've also felt sort of hopeful to hear from experts that among younger doctors and medical students today, there's more of a demand for this knowledge, a recognition that they, you know, want to have, be equipped with the knowledge to treat their female patients as well as they can treat their male patients.
So it's one thing just to rely on the doctors themselves, but when it comes to women actually being able to advocate for themselves or to make a change in the wider community, you write that the internet has been invaluable.
Yeah. So, I mean, just in terms of giving patients the opportunity to connect with each other and kind of see that their experiences are similar, trade knowledge and advice on good doctors to go to. And I think that that kind of community online can be a way of not just helping each other get the care they need, but validating the reality of their diseases.
So my final question to you, there's so many women who are listening right now to you. What would you have them say the next time they are feeling dismissed at a hospital, at a doctor's visit?
I know my body. I know what I'm experiencing is something that is abnormal for me. You need to take it seriously or else I'm going to find somebody else. You know, we're allowed to fire our doctors. They work for us. You don't have to stay in a relationship where you're feeling dismissed all the time.
That's going to stick with me. We are allowed to fire our doctors. You do not have to stay in a relationship where you are feeling dismissed. Maya Dusenberry, author of Doing Harm, The Truth About How Bad Medicine and Lazy Science Leave Women Dismissed, Misdiagnosed, and Sick. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find our whole series, Taking Pains with Women's Health, at thetakeaway.org/womenspain. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Duarte Geraldino. This is The Takeaway.
They're willing to make the ultimate sacrifice, and yet undocumented vets can still be pushed out.
If we were willing to give our lives for the country, I think we should be able to live there. You know, that's my place, you know.
A look at what happens when lack of care for veterans leads to trouble with the law and sometimes deportation. That's next time on the Takeaway Podcast.